Hey everybody, wow, I cannot believe it, but this is episode number one. It has been such a long journey, not only in setting all this up, but just the years and years of absorbing information, information that I can't wait to share. But before I begin, I have to give my acknowledgments on the record here to people that have shaped my life the most. To start with, my father. I must have been 4 or 5 years old when he asked me a question, as simplistic as it was, that was a lesson I would carry with me throughout my entire life. How would you like it if we had to fill out paperwork and get permission from the government to go to the store or the pool or the mall? I don't remember my answer, but I remember this. That was the moment I was taught about the necessity of freedom. When I first entered into college, I was on the brink of socialism. My first 2 semesters were filled with more than a few Marxist rants from professors. But in my 3rd semester of college, I took an economics class. I had a great teacher. I remember one day in class, a girl that sat in front of me was an avowed leftist, and she asked the teacher, "Why can't we just print more money? Wouldn't this help people?" He gave the class a beautifully concise lesson in scarcity, and thus marks the second turning point in my life. After that semester ended, I remember having so many questions that I needed the answers to because my whole world had been turned upside down. I was forced to think about things critically. I immediately found Walter Williams, Thomas Sowell, and Milton Friedman, all of whom were my original influences in economics, and eventually I found the great one, Dr. Ron Paul. It's hard to describe the greatness of this man in a few words because you could just point out so many things. How about the fact that he never voted to raise taxes? But the main thing that attracted me to his way of thinking was his brutal honesty. He got up on those debate stages and said things that were difficult to say, and he did it with dignity. And I've made that my life goal, to tell the truth. And if people criticize me, so what? Their lies hold no ground, and they are certainly not in command of the facts. But there are 2 more people who have done more than anyone else in regards to my thinking. One of them is thankfully still here with us today, while the other left behind a legacy so spectacular that it's almost impossible to believe. The latter, of course, is Murray Rothbard. Murray was, in my mind, the greatest scholar that ever lived. I could spend hours speaking highly of him, but the most important takeaway here is he pursued knowledge from the perspective of peace and liberty, and that's my goal. He always noted that the educational system favors modern state narratives, especially over the ones that leave liberty intact. His words will never be forgotten. And lastly, there is Dr. Tom Woods, who I can't thank enough. Thank you, Dr. Woods, for leading me down the path to be a scholar, for your endless wisdom, and for the incredible amount you've done for the cause of liberty. I hope you give yourself enough credit. Whether you realize it or not, you have changed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, including myself. I would highly suggest anybody go to tomwoods.com, see all he has to offer, check out Liberty Classroom, which has given me more knowledge than all of my years of schooling combined, hands down. Everything this podcast represents will be in the name of peace and liberty. Thank you all so much, and I hope you enjoy episode one. Hey everyone, welcome to the Peace and Liberty Podcast, episode one. I'm your host, Stephen Clyde. I'm super excited to have the opportunity to start the show, and I have 2 main goals. One is to bring more people towards the ideas of peace and liberty, and 2 is to provide a message that is easily conveyed, and in which you all, whether you're a libertarian or not, can go out and do exactly what I'm doing, which is simply to talk to other people. And it's much different when you're communicating with an extensive amount of facts on command versus simply repeating talking points that your side conveys. Let me give you 2 examples. Taxes are the prices we pay for a civilized society. I drive on roads to get around. I use the post office. And overall, I have access to many things that make my life better. Did I get that one literally word for word? Or how about this? Without the government, there would be chaos. At a minimal level, I need the government to protect us from domestic disputes and from foreign invasion and to enforce contracts. Now, without even getting into the merits of either of these claims, the point is that in the political climate today, people generally talk to each other in this manner. They have one-liner talking points that make them feel brilliant when they can even recall them. And sadly, they have no real influence over anyone, except other people who find gratification in doing the same thing. So it's much easier to attack people in this way when the attacker is so arrogant that instead of even thinking about researching the claims they make, they find comfort in the fact that their one-liners sometimes work and shutting their opponent down. It's as simple as that. So I got involved in libertarianism around 2010 when I heard Ron Paul speak. And does the story sound familiar, by the way? This seems to be the story for many libertarians. He was saying things that nobody else was saying at the time. I first heard the terms Austrian economics, Mises, blowback, and a crowd favorite, taxation is theft. But even then, for years, I felt so confident that I'd found the most sound ideology that I kind of stopped there. Surely I'd listen to videos and read an article here or there, but I never thought to engage myself academically and to read the so-called Mises guy. I eventually picked up a copy of Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt, and the first chapter alone blew me away. I remember putting the book down after reading the first two chapters, and I was pacing around my apartment because it was like a fireworks display had went off. I never thought about it that way, but yet it's so obvious. From there, my own intellectual journey began. So the purpose of this episode is to provide a basic analysis of how libertarianism evolved, its main contributors, and in general, when people ask me what is libertarianism, I can direct them to episode one. This is going to be one you can share to your friends and family who are just learning about these ideas. And I urge everyone to absorb this information for themselves because it's easy to forget things unless you think about them a lot and talk about them a lot. So I'm going to start my overall discussion like this. Each individual throughout their lives will have to answer the question. A reasonable debate about the role of government can't take place and shouldn't take place until this question is answered. The question will often be overlooked, as the notions imply accountability to certain people in ways that become obvious. The question forces you to justify your belief starting on a moral principle rather than an artificial principle that is simply used for convenience. The question is this: is the use of aggression against peaceful and non-coercive individuals ever justified? And the short answer is no, it isn't. Now, throughout history, we notice war and chaos are very prominent themes, even today. And it really was only in the last few centuries that we saw the vast improvements in the quality of life. In the past 30 years alone, for example, global poverty has fell by nearly 80%. This is billions of people that have been lifted out of poverty. Billions with a B. So the story of how libertarianism evolved, though ultimately established by Murray Rothbard, goes back much farther in history. Many may be familiar with the fact that ancient Greece played a large role in developing ideas that led to the creation of Western civilization. For example, there was the poet Hesiod, thought to have written in the 6th and 7th century BC. He gave us some of the first insights into scarcity. Democritus of the 3rd and 4th century BC can be said to have given us the idea of subjective value theory and was in favor of private property over communal property. Quoting Democritus, he said, "The same thing may be good and true for all men, but the pleasant differs from one and another." Plato, who most of us have heard of, had some rather statist ideas about how society should be constructed. In fact, in The Republic and the Laws, he described the idea of a Greek polis, or city, where philosophers and soldiers would rule over laborers, peasants, and merchants. Yet, even Plato recognized the role of the division of labor. Xenophon, who was a follower of Plato, noted that people that lived in cities were often able to get by in a single trade, whereas living in a rural area, it was necessary to be a jack of all trades. Really think about that, because that's a brilliant insight into supply and demand and how if the neighbor closest to you is miles away, you will inevitably have to take on more responsibility and learn how to do more things. It's a brilliant insight. Now, Aristotle, who in my opinion was a much more sound philosopher, though even he had his errors, was a great proponent of private property and disagreed with his teacher Plato in many ways. Instead, he argued that private property is interwoven into our human nature, which then in turn gives us the ability to act morally and compassionately. Cicero of the first century BC was a famous Roman statesman, jurist, and orator. He heavily influenced the idea of Stoic natural law, doctrines which, quote, heavily influenced the Roman jurists of the second and third centuries AD, according to Rothbard. Despite all these contributions, Rothbard was of the opinion that the first libertarians weren't the ancient Greeks. And it was Hayek that once said, intellectuals are secondhand dealers in ideas. What he meant by that is, whoever is stated to be the creator of an idea, they usually aren't. They usually aren't. Now, Taoism, also known as Taoism, is an often overlooked chapter of libertarian thought because back in ancient China, there were three main schools of thought. There were legalists, Confucians, and Taoists. Legalists wanted to maximize state functions, while Confucians, coming from the school of thought of Confucius, had a less oppressive vision of the law and rulers, but nonetheless leaned towards the need for governments from philosophers. The Taoists, however, held opinions that were way ahead of their time. Lao Tzu, who lived from 604 to 531 BC, was a friend of Confucius's, and he believed that an individual's happiness was a source of society's prosperity, and that rulers simply interfered. The government, according to him, and I'm quoting him now, with its laws and regulations more numerous than the hairs of an ox, was more to be feared than fierce tigers. And he wasn't arrogant at all regarding the effects of war and taxation, quoting him again. He said, the people hunger because their superiors consume an excess in taxation. And he goes on to say, where armies have been stationed, thorns and brambles grow. After a great war, harsh years of famine are sure to follow. He also took note that humans left to their own devices tend to procure their own need in life. And quoting him again, I take no action, yet the people transform themselves. I favor quiescence and people right themselves. I take no action and the people enrich themselves. If this interests you, also research Chang Zhu of the 3rd century BC, who Rothbard called the first anarchist in the history of human thought, and also Pao Ching Yan of the 5th century AD, who he was heavily influenced by these thinkers. You have Sima Qian of the 2nd century BC, gave some of the most important insights in the relationship between minimal government and the abundance of goods. And in the future, I will expand on these topics, but let's fast forward to the late 17th century. You had people like John Locke, who gave some of the most profound insights into the idea of natural rights. And Locke was widely read in the American colonies. In fact, few people know this, and it's one of my favorite stories, but Murray Rothbard was actually the person that gave the Cato Institute its name. And this is based off Cato's letters, which was 144 essays published between 1720 to 1723. Now, this was based off Cato the Elder, which was a Roman senator, and he wrote about the idea such as that power must be kept limited, and quoting Cato, we know by infinite examples and experience that men possessed of power, rather than part with it, will do anything, even the worst and most blackest, to keep it. The idea of natural rights eventually found its way into the Declaration of Independence, and was an idea that led to actual independence from Britain. Now, here's where it gets interesting. If you had the chance to ask Karl Marx what history is, he would have stated, the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles, which, of course, is the first sentence to the chapter one of the Communist Manifesto, which came out in February 1848. What he meant by that was that there was two classes in society over the course of history, one that owns the means of production and the other who is forced to sell their labor power to the owners of the means of production. So at this time, the Industrial Revolution had created a much different way of life. You had innovative technology being produced that increased productivity immensely, and slowly but surely, people found their way out of poverty. This way of thinking led to many of the communist revolutions you may have read about. The First International, which was a communist organization formed in 1864, eventually led to the failed Paris Commune of the 1870s. In 1889, the Second International was found. But it's interesting, in 1872, the Marxist and anarchist factions separated. So if you look at the interactions, for example, between Marx and Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, for example, Proudhon came out with a book called The Philosophy of Poverty. He came out with that in 1847. Marx, in response, and as a brutal critic, came out with a book called The Poverty of Philosophy. And it's important to remember, and this is inscribed on Marx's grave, the quote that the philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. So Marx would make fun of anarchists constantly, saying they're useless and goalless. And when you get into the later revolutions, such as the February and October revolutions, Lenin had interpreted these in the most evil and menacing ways possible. And I'll eventually dedicate entire episodes to these revolutions. But getting back to libertarianism, we see a strong divergence between those that favor state power and those that disagree with state power on principle. Mostly in the 1860s and the 1870s, you see a strong divergence. So Karl Menger, with his 1871 book, Principles of Economics, this paved the way to what we in economics call the marginal revolution. So ideas such as the subjective theory of value, in contrast with the labor theory of value, which was espoused by Smith and Marx, this turned economics on its head. You got to think the idea that each individual values things subjectively, and that I can value a watch for $100, someone could value the same watch for $50 or $0. And these were new ideas that would lead to other scholars to add on to these concepts. For example, Eugen Boom Bawrick came out with a book titled Marx and the Close of a System, which came out in 1896. That was a devastating critique of socialism. He essentially would restate Marx's arguments better than he even could, then demolish the arguments completely. He does that over and over and over again in that book. There's many others I will discuss eventually, but Ludwig von Mises, with his 1949 treatise titled Human Action, which is right behind me, was the most fundamental piece of economic literature ever published. And when Rothbard would actually hear about this book that was about to come out, it was described to him as a book about everything. And of course, the rumors were true. Economists like Friedrich von Hayek, who would slightly diverge from Mises a few points, but who also earned the Nobel Prize in economics for his work in Austrian business cycle theory. He pointed out that capitalism is not prone to booms and busts, but rather that artificially setting interest rates along with other faulty monetary policies will warp investment and lead to unsustainable booms based on investors being drunk on cheap loans, metaphorically. This was in 1974, a year after Mises had passed away. So Murray Rothbard, in an attempt to write a more comprehensible version of Human Action, because Human Action is a very, very, very dense book. It's you can't read it fast. He published Man, Economy, and State, which is right behind me, in 1962. This propelled libertarianism forward in a way that history doesn't give him enough credit for. He would go on to write countless books, thousands and thousands of articles throughout many outlets. And out of all his works, he wrote the small essay, Anatomy of the State, which is also a short book now, is the most devastating critique of the state ever written. He argues, for example, that the state is not an institution of social service. That if we are the government, well, this is an absurd idea. If we are the government, then anything the government does is justified. Or in other words, it is just us doing it to ourselves. If the government is responsible for a Holocaust that kills 6 million Jews, well, it's really voluntary suicide on their behalf. And surely this is an absurd argument, but this is how the logic would follow. He argues that what the state is instead is, as Franz Oppenheimer would put it, the organization of the political means. Quoting from the book again, Oppenheimer argues that there are only two mutually exclusive ways of acquiring wealth. One, the economic means. The other way is simpler in that it does not require productivity. It is the way of seizure of another's goods or services by the use of force and violence, which Oppenheimer termed the political means. So if the state, by definition, is an institution of force and violence, then how does it preserve itself? Well, Murray argues that it does it through many methods. By guilt, or in other words, quote, any increase in private well-being can be attacked as unconscionable greed, materialism, or excessive affluence. And also, they instill fear in us by they say we're doomed to fail without them and that we're in good hands with them. Of course, the more modern and sinister version of rule we have claims they're ultra-scientific. Relating to Keynes and Keynesianism, Murray notes that a robber who justified his theft by saying that he really helped his victims by his pending giving a boost to retail trade would find few converts. But when this theory is clothed in Keynesian equations and impressive references to the multiplier effect, it unfortunately carries more conviction. I could go on and on about a discussion of Murray's work, but I hope that after hearing a lot of this, you have the inspiration to go read these things for yourself. I'm going to wrap up here by giving a summary of what libertarianism is. And in short, libertarianism is the idea that each individual person is endowed, whether by their God or by their own objective realization of this fact, that people have natural rights or negative rights. Negative rights is the idea that you have the right not to have violence used against you and the right not to be deprived of your property for unjust reasons. The difference between this idea and positive rights would be this, that a positive right would state that I have the right to example, for example, to food or water or shelter. This is a fallacy. You do not have the right to products of other people's labor, namely filtered water, food that has been grown and harvested, and other people's private property. John Locke, who I mentioned earlier, had the idea of homesteading, and that if you mix your labor with the soil, you now have a property title to that area. And from there, property is just simply transferred on a title basis. I'll dedicate a whole episode eventually to Crusoe economics, which explains these ideas from the ground up. Robinson Crusoe is stranded on an island and he has to make decisions based on scarce resources. And how does he do this? So that's basically the idea of that. So in essence, libertarianism argues that individuals, rather than a collectivist society, is worthy of praise because it's really individuals, each with their distinct and idiosyncratic perspectives, that bring into fruition the abundance of things we have access to nowadays. Humans are not robots and are not some variables in a math equation. Humans are unique. So if we concede that people have negative rights, we inevitably follow the ideal of the non-aggression principle. This simply states that I don't have a right to attack, molest, rape, or kill you, and vice versa. To argue against this, as Hans Hermann Hoppe states regarding his idea of argumentation ethics, would be a contradiction. To argue against the idea of natural rights and private property is to take advantage of both these instances while engaging in this diatribe. If I were to walk up to someone and state that I believe freedom of speech should be limited, only under the circumstance of me having my free speech violated at that very moment, is that not a contradiction? In other words, it's non sequitur to actively use free speech to rail against free speech. It's the same thing with property. For me to state that I think property is theft, which Proudhon certainly did in his 1840 book, What is Property?, is to actively take advantage of the fact that my private property isn't being violated at this very moment. I wake up and I use the property right to own the shirt on my back without it being stripped away. I have the property right of my apartment. I hop in my car every day and drive to the store and I use the property rights in relation to my car title, and on and on and on. You cannot argue against libertarianism without contradiction. Well, guys, I've surely covered a lot here in a short amount of time, and this is just a glimpse of what's in store for you as a listener of this podcast. So either right now or after this ends, hit the subscribe button down below. Let's get this information out to more people. I'm going to end with this quote by Murray. The greatest danger to the state is independent intellectual criticism. Use the things you learn here to go out and change the world. Start a conversation with a stranger. Challenge people's ideas. Write a book. Start a movement. Go be somebody. You can make a change. And this isn't like Obama's change, folks. The message of peace and liberty will continue on. My name is Stephen Clyde, and this is the Peace and Liberty Podcast, as always, for peace and liberty. See you tomorrow. Hey, everyone. Please like, follow, donate, subscribe, and share. Any donations will be used to reach more people.